Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
And good evening. Thanks for joining us on this July 4th. And I know for many of you will be busy partying and enjoying your family. So my guess is we're going to have a lot more people that are going to be listening to us. As we say in this business, asymmetrically, you'll be listening to us at a time other than when the show is on. And because the studio is closed on July 4th, we had a pre-record this program, but I think it's a very special program for July 4th. My guest is E.J. Drury, the author of A Different Kind of Sentinel, which is about healing the inner wounds of war. He's a Vietnam vet and developed a whole process for dealing with that. And this issue, which is different from most other PTSD, is now being called by the Marine Corps moral injury. It's not the terror and the trauma that causes the injury. It's the inner struggle of what the person did during the war. It's really fascinating work, and it's really shamanic work. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And I wasn't sure what the appropriate topic was for today. And then I had a conversation with a client, somebody I've done work with several times, and realized exactly what the appropriate topic is going to be. She was talking about how things were feeling more difficult in some ways. She had physical problems that she hadn't had before. She became sensitive to gluten, various kinds of other strange things going on in her body. And she said, "Yeah, what's going on? Why would this be happening now?" And there's a very important set of reasons and understandings about why so many of us are going through not only strange physical symptoms, but also all kinds of emotional upheaval and changes. And that's what's the name for this phenomenon is ascension, which is kind of an off-putting, strange word. But what it means is that the frequency, the vibration of the planet is rising. So everything is moving energetically at a faster pace. And what that means is that anything on the physical or within you that is vibrating at lower frequency is going to get churned up and come to the surface. Well, what does that look like? It looks like emotional upheaval and physical symptoms and all kinds of strange things in the news and bizarre weather. So when you think about the frequency going up, that's kind of abstract. What does that mean? But there are physical phenomena going on that are the physical side of this ascension process, which really don't get talked about much. And I'm very fortunate to have my friend Claudia McNeely, who's been on the show several times, and she tracks some of these phenomena and does a daily posting about it on Facebook, among other places. And it lets you get a handle on how much is changing. So sunspot activity is at a higher level than any time in recorded history. No time since scientists have been looking at this stuff has sun activity been this dramatic. In addition to that, there's solar wind, which is a stream of charged particles that moves across space and affects the Earth. It affects the Earth so powerfully, it can push the Earth's magnetic field to the side. This, we're talking about major, major phenomena. So what is that about? Well, it's bringing more energy into the energetic field of the planet. It's happening not just in some strange, we can't figure out what we mean when we talk about it, energy phenomenon, but it's also happening in the physical world in things that scientists are tracking. The other thing that's happening, which again, I've heard about it for several years, but most people are just not talking about it anywhere, is that the North Pole is fairly quickly in geological terms, moving towards Siberia and moving at, for geological terms, a very rapid rate. And that means that the Earth is tilting slightly differently, and that means that the sun is hitting the Earth slightly differently, and different places are heating up, and the jet stream is changing. So even though there are issues we call global warming, and they're real, and even though there are man-made phenomena, some of them intentional, which affect the weather, and they are real, there is something about the cycle of what's going on in this planet that is changing things. And if you want to get a sense of what I mean by the poles being slightly different, and I can't believe that I'm the only person that notices this stuff, watch where the sun rises and sets. I noticed, starting 2 years ago, that the sun was rising and setting at different times of years between different buildings that it did than it did before at the same time of year. It's really interesting. It's totally noticeable, but nobody's mentioning it. So what all that means is that we're all experiencing upheaval emotionally and spiritually and physically, and all of that needs to be healed, and there's all kinds of ways to do that, and that's really what the show is about, is talking about all the amazing methods and all the people that are doing healing work and how much we need that work right now, because it's like we're all going through a Reiki treatment at an extremely powerful level every single day, and everybody's walking around like nothing's going on. Well, a lot's going on. So we will continue the conversation and probably have Claudia on again at some point to talk about it. But there's a lot going on, folks. There's a reason why things feel strange at the moment. I want to remind people that you can listen to the show anytime after the show airs at 9 p.m. today at thefarkasfiles.com. And you can listen directly on that page. You can also find it on iTunes podcasts. So for those of you who can't listen because it's July 4th and you're busy doing fun things, or because you never managed to catch the show at 9 p.m. on a Thursday because that doesn't fit your schedule, you can always listen to the show. It's usually posted within half an hour to an hour after the show is completed, and it's always available. And the whole archive is there. We have probably 60 or more shows in the archive of fascinating people like my guest tonight, E.J. Drury. And so that's tonight's metaphysical musing. In a couple of minutes, we'll have E.J. Drury on the line. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation because it's a conversation about something that we all need to be aware of. So let's get started. E.J. Drury has an incredible story, and I don't know that I could do him justice in a quick introduction, so let's just bring him on and start hearing his story. EJ, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Actually, that for many of the people listening, it's going to be evening, which is
okay.
People listen at all kinds of times. You have an amazing story. You're a veteran, but you have a family history as well that informs the place that you went with all this. You figured out a lot of things that a lot of people never figure out. So what I typically do with all my guests is ask them for their story. You know, what was the walk about? What was the dark night of the soul? And your book, A Different Kind of Sentinel, and everything that I've read about you is really about your life story. So can you give us the introduction version, and then we'll go further with it?
Sure. Sounds good. Really what the book deals with is dealing with the beastly side of human nature. And when we were children, we're trained to not poke people in the eye or kick them or hit them, more to talk to them and share our feelings instead. But then when we go into the military, the opposite thing is done. Instead of suppressing the beast, the human side of us is suppressed, and the beast is trained. And right. It's trained to kill others without fear of punishment. And then, you know, when we get ready to leave the military, we leave with conflicting emotions as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then, you know, we spend the rest of our lives struggling to put Hyde back in the box or to transform him. And basically, that's what my book is about, you know, dealing with Hyde or the beastly side of our human nature.
Right. And you're, in terms of your background, you're a Vietnam vet.
Yes, I am. I was in the Navy, 67 through 69. We made one tour to Vietnam, did shore bombardments, and then I came back to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finally discharged in 1968. But, you know, it's interesting because back then it was a draft military. Well, the Navy wasn't enlisted. But, you know, the first day I was on that ship, it's just truly amazing how much hate there was, for the military. And, you know, there one guy came up to me and says, yeah, you know, don't don't let them mess with your mind because they're going to turn you into an animal. And then just before I was one of my buddies was being discharged from the ship, he told me, you know, don't let them take your humanity away because they'll claw at it until all that's left of you is a shadow of what was once you. And so what you saw on the ship was exactly what was going on outside in society. You know, there were those who were against Vietnam War, and then there were those who were, you know, the American position. And actually, we almost fought between ourselves harder than we were actually fighting the enemy. It was the bizarrest experience I'd ever been thrust into. I just had no idea, you know, when I was transferred to that ship that I was going to get into a conflict over the war, you know.
Right. Well, it was probably the most divisive, strange war that this country ever went into, politically at home, but also evidently in the military. And, but that whole idea of them feeding the beast and training you to, spend your time and your focus in that dark side of yourself. We could talk a little bit about how that's done, but the real thing is that you come out of it with all of that still active, and
at the same time
you're trying to re-enter into society and figure out who you are in this, you know, new environment because you've been in the other environment for so long.
Sure,
you know. I know that you've come up with all kinds of ways to deal with that, and I want to hear about that, but you've got a whole other side to understanding that beastly side of things and the confusion of life, which came out of your family life. You know, from what I read, both your father and your stepfather were, shall we say, challenging people.
Yes, they were both... Well, my stepfather, or my real father, actually was a paranoid schizophrenic and was hospitalized when I was 3 years old. And then when my mom remarried some years later, the guy she married was turned into an alcoholic. But both of them just suffered terribly the nightmarish experiences they had in the South Pacific during World War II. And, you know, I decided at the point that I went into the service that there was no way I was going to let that happen to me. And no one was going to force me to kill another human being and then live with that nightmare for the rest of my life. I'm kind of reminded of a story that came out a while back. There was a veteran from World War II that was being interviewed. And the end of the war had just happened the very day he was sitting here by a tree. And there's this German soldier that came walking up towards him. And, you know, he still had his rifle in his hand, and the German soldier had his rifle in his hand. And he didn't know whether this guy's intentions were good or bad, you know. So he ends up shooting the guy and killing him. And this guy is in his 90s, and he said, there's not a day that hasn't gone by that I don't relive that scene over and over. And the first time he ever talked about it was this television interview. But he had lived with that all of his life without expressing it to anyone or anybody ever having heard it before. You know, which would have been a very, very difficult life to me. But I mean, he survived and he did well. I mean, he didn't become an alcoholic or anything like that. But you just imagine the pain that he suffered the rest of his life.
My dad told a story like that, and I'm probably the only one that heard it. And he was not in combat for most of his tour. He was a supply sergeant in the Army Air Corps, breaking all the rules to make sure that everybody had what they needed. And, you know, I think it was at night, and his Jeep was attacked. So they got behind the Jeep and returned fire, and all he had was a sidearm. And there was shooting, and he shot back, and then there was no shooting. So he never saw what happened. But his sense was that he killed somebody. And they obviously didn't wait around and look and try and figure it out. They got in the Jeep and they left. But that haunted him his whole life. And I found out about it when there was a gun amnesty to return firearms, no questions asked, in New York City. And he was looking for his sidearm, which he hadn't been able to find. And he was looking in closets and, you know, trying to figure out what he had done with it. And he told me that story. And I don't think anybody else ever knew that was going on and that it haunted him. So for people that were in combat, I can't even imagine how overwhelming that is.
Yeah. I mean, just recently take the news where that that drone pilot had been told that he killed 1,626 people, and his first victim, he blew his leg off with the drone and watched him bleed to death, and watched his body turn cold as the ground because he was using heat sensing or imaging equipment. And, you know, that guy's going to live with that stuff for the rest of his life. But, you know, the thing that is a little different for this guy is that he's getting out now and he's sharing it. He's getting it out of his system, and that's just so important. To get that poison out of you. You know, like when you know, these guys come back, you know, they got all these images that they don't know what to do with, and they need to find somebody, almost like a confessor or a friend or a doctor or somebody that they can let that out, that won't be judgmental, and let him know that no matter what he did or how horrible the things were that happened, that he's still loved. And that you forgive them, that's just so important for the healing process to begin.
So, you know, one of the obvious things that happens a lot for, you know, and we now call this PTSD, which is partly just the effect of being in war and being confronted constantly with not knowing what's going to happen next and the terror of it all. But a lot of returning veterans have all kinds of problems, including suicides and becoming homeless and drug and alcohol problems. And you've worked on some ways to help them.
Yes. You know, there's a natural law, and it states that nature must be obeyed one way or the other, as either an unconscious animal in which you take the images that pop into your head and you perform them exactly as you see them in your head, or you look at them through the eyes of a conscious human being, and you look for the meaning of these images. And as an example, take the soldier who wants to commit suicide. He really doesn't want to kill his personal being. You know, what he wants is he wants to kill a self that no longer suits him or never did suit him in the past. And he can only do that by returning to his imagination, like I have in A Different Kind of Sentinel, and slaying the beast that he's become before it kills him. And kill him it will if he doesn't do something with it.
So,
and then, you know, it's kind of the same thing with somebody who suffers PTSD. You know, they too can find there's a number of ways. We have a Veterans for Peace group here in St. Louis that occasionally takes vets back to Vietnam, and they actually meet Vietnamese that they fought against on the same battlefield. Wow. These guys get together, they talk, and it's just an incredible healing experience for some of these guys who have borne the pain of these conflicts. And, you know, for those who are not able to go back to a battlefield, like, I mean, obviously you couldn't want to go back to Iraq or Afghanistan right now and talk to your enemies, but, you know, there's a process that in Jungian psychology called active imagination, where you sit down and you let just whatever's bothering you inside just pour out of you, put it down on paper, whatever, however you want to express it. And sometimes what will happen is you'll meet figures there that are haunting you. And sometimes I think these soldiers are haunted by the very images of the people that they killed. And what you can do with active imagination is the same thing that took place with a guy going over to Vietnam. You can ask that figure when you see him in your imagination for forgiveness, and then forgive anybody else that for whatever your trespasses were. Mm-hmm. And that can be very, very healing.
Well, forgiving yourself, from my perspective and what I've learned along the way, is basically the healing method for everything.
It is. And it's the hardest thing to do is to forgive yourself.
Right. Especially when you did something which before you were in the military, you never would have expected or allowed yourself to do, that, compromised everything that you were raised with. Trying to formulate the question here, you've obviously worked with a lot of veterans and worked with a lot of people with PTSD. And the way that they tend to act it out is that their life comes apart. They just can't do what they need to do to have a place to live, to do anything else, and the pain's overwhelming. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've learned about that and how you break that cycle, how you help them to feel okay about it?
Yeah, there's several ways, really. When I came out of the service back in 69, I basically just drifted around the country for about a year and a half. And, when you see vets coming back now, they've got a family responsibility, kids, there has to be a dad. They're asked to go to work, but yet all this stuff is just roiling around inside them. And, when I look back at my own self, there's no way in hell that I could have ever held a job or taken the responsibility of the family. And that's what was the beginning of the healing process. And there are several things that are taking place today that sort of address that. There's a place up in Minnesota that actually takes vets and works them on a farm, and they stay there for a year, and basically kind of what you're doing in that situation is you're getting back in touch with the ground of being, if you want to say. And there was kind of a similar experience back in the early centuries of say the church, where they finally said that, well, killing in war was okay. Well, some of these guys that came back, would be suffering the same kinds of things. And one of the prescriptions for them was to go off and live in the woods like an animal for a year. And basically what that did was it got them grounded again, got them back in touch, with their humanity. So, I mean, there's a lot of those kinds of things that we could do that would help that situation. But gosh, to throw some guy that came back like myself right into a family and into a job, I tell you, I probably would have fallen apart too.
Right.
I couldn't have done it.
That method that you're talking about is very common in indigenous cultures all over the world. And I want to talk about that, but we're going to need to go to a break in a minute. I want to make sure people know how to get in touch with you. My guest is E.J. Drury, the author of A Different Kind of Sentinel, which is available on Amazon and I assume everywhere else. But do you have a website as well?
I do. You can I blog off of Facebook, and you can reach me at Sir E.J. Drury, D-R-U-R-Y, Roman numeral 2, Facebook.com. You can find the book at www.rivendellbooks.com and also at Amazon. The paperback and the ebook is both available there.
Fantastic. We are going to take a short break. We will be right back with E.J. Drury and his incredible story. here on the Farkas Files. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Packers.
Vikings.
Red State.
Blue State.
We come from different places.
Uptown.
Downtown.
We come to different conclusions.
Half empty.
Half full.
But no matter how different we are, we're all connected, and we can all make a difference. That's why United Way brings people, expertise, and resources together to improve the education, income, and health of our communities. The building blocks for a better life. When we live united, our efforts, magnified by others, add up to real change. Children succeed in school, families gain financial stability, the health of our neighbors improves, and suddenly, so do our communities. But real change won't happen without you.
Live united.
So let's look beyond our differences.
Live united.
One by one, let's make a difference. Let's reach out a hand to one and influence the condition of all.
Live united.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Sign up today at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
If a disaster struck right now, what would you and your family do first? Would you stay where you are or leave? What if you and your family were separated? Would your kids know what to do? How would you get in touch with them if your cell phone isn't working or the subways aren't running? Don't wait until a disaster strikes to figure it out. It's your responsibility to make a plan for you and your family ahead of time. To learn how, take our readiness challenge at nyc.gov/readynewyork or call 311 for information. In this online tool, you'll be faced with real-life challenges, forcing you to make quick decisions at every turn to teach you the importance of being prepared for a disaster. Without a plan, it's like you're putting your family in a disaster. Visit nyc.gov/readynewyork or call 311 for information. A public service announcement brought to you by the New York City Office of Emergency Management and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called inventnow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cat stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See, that's proof. You should go to the inventnow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with E.J. Drury, the author of A Different Kind of Sentinel. And I want to pick up on what you were saying just before the break, which was the idea of either going to a farm and basically being with the animals and with nature, or going out into nature in a kind of survival process alone and just getting in touch with nature. And that's the classic vision quest or walkabout that indigenous cultures all over the world have as an initiation, and something I talk about all the time. So I'm really fascinated that you're including it as one of the methods that actually worked with vets, and that there are some people that are providing it to them. So tell me about that process. You know, how was it structured for people to go out into the wilderness and do what they needed to? Were there people that were helping them set that up?
Actually, I'm kind of I like Vision Quest too. It's one of my favorite things, and you can actually say that my book is basically a vision quest, trying to revision my life as to what what it should be, or what I'm meant to be, the person I am. And there are other ways too. There's a group here in St. Louis she takes stories and encourages, you know, vets to write down their stories, and she has put these in a book, a collection of short stories, and you know it was well received, and she's so well received that she's working on a second one, and this is another way of, you know, of these guys being healed. You know, and like, you know, when you look to like South Africa, for example, when they had finally gotten rid of apartheid there, Desmond Tutu had, you know, decided not to have, you know, prosecute these guys, but rather have them he wanted to hear their confessions. And I remember when they were doing a spot on him on television one time, he was in one of these confessions, and you could hear him in there just screaming out, oh, at the horror of what he was hearing. And then right. Not only did he have to listen to this and listen to the horror of it, but he had to turn around and forgive these guys.
Right.
And, you know, that's essentially what we have to do with our vets. Or, you know, there's this poison that just kind of roils around in them. And it's got to be expressed some way, whether it be on a farm in Minnesota, whether it be writing a story for a short story book, whether it be talking to a confessor, or whether it be living off the land for a year, whatever it is, you need to find that, you know, before that poison just kills you or destroys you.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you were talking about how people are raised to, you know, as we say to little kids, use your words and not hit. And in the military, you turn that around completely. But there's also the sense of the military being honored and patriotic and being proud of your service and all of that, which is totally valid in one way, but also makes it very difficult for somebody with a horrible story that they need to express to overcome their sense of betrayal of patriotism and honor and the service that they were in and their comrades and all the rest of it. So there's another overlay that makes it really hard for them to let all that go and even talk about it. Do you think that sense of betrayal is a big piece of this?
No, you know, and that's exactly what PTSD is. There's recent studies that have come down and said that PTSD is the result of a moral dilemma, and that's the dilemma that you're saying. You know, they're honored and the military's looked at as a great thing. They're doing something for their country and stuff like that, but yet they've done all these horrible things, and that's exactly what they can't reconcile and what they need to reconcile. And again, I don't know of any other way than, you know, letting these guys tell their stories and, you know, forgiving them, and I mean genuinely right. forgiving them, and be able to love them. There was I don't know if I mentioned the story about the drone pilot killing yeah. 1,626. Did I mention that?
Yeah, you did. And okay. And I find the fact that drone pilots are going through the same experience.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not only fascinating,
you know, but it's
actually encouraging, because what everyone says about drone pilots is that it's like a video game and they don't, you know, they can do it without emotion. And exactly. I'm actually encouraged to know that for them, it's a real combat situation and they do have emotion about it.
Yeah. In fact, that same drone pilot, he said, I thought it was like a video game. He says, I became basically a sociopath. And he said that he was dating a girl, and she said when he told her that he was responsible for a lot of deaths as a drone pilot, she backed off from him as he was this monster, and she wouldn't have anything to do with it. She wouldn't touch him. She never would right. touch him again. And, you know, that is that beast, you know, that has come out that, you know, needs to be dealt with and put back in his box or transformed. And, you know, like I said earlier, that drone pilot is going about it the right way. He's getting it out, you know, and not let, you know, destroy him. But he's going to have to live with those images for the rest of his life. That's a hell
right.
of a...
Right. Well, and another thing that I notice about people with PTSD and the stories is the horror of watching the people that you love, that you're serving with, get killed right next to you. You know, having terrible things
exactly.
happen to people that you love, and
sure.
still have to keep moving and do the next thing
sure.
because
sure.
you have
sure.
to protect more people. And You know, and that's, and I'm not a combat veteran, so I'm not speaking from that experience, but there's that combination of protecting and defending the people that you love that are there fighting this fight with you. At the same time, you're doing things that before you were in that situation, you would have considered reprehensible. So you're even there, the moral dilemma is I have to do this because otherwise my buddies are going to die and the military depends on that. But at the same time, looking at it and saying, what am I doing?
And, you know, basically we place our boys in there as, you know, in survival of the fittest, basically. And you're not only the hunter, but you're the hunted.
Right.
And it's a terrible situation to be in.
Yeah, it's I have some work that I do, which is on a spiritual level, and I've had only a few opportunities to work on returning veterans, and it's been helpful. So I'm actually looking for ways to connect with people that have PTSD to see how effective these methods will be, and the images that I use in my work are ghosts and demons. You know, the demon being pretty much what you would talk about as the beast, but something that takes you and pulls you into doing these terrible things and feeds on the energy of you doing it and gets stronger because you're doing it. And the ghosts, you know, you could say being literally what's left behind from the people both that you loved and died next to you, but also of the people that you killed in close combat. So it's a different way of looking at it and a different set of images, but it basically comes down to the same stuff that you're talking about. And
there was a doctor that I know that doctors out of Albany, New York, and he told the story of a patient that he had who was, this guy was like a motorcycle dude, you know, had been in Vietnam, had been a part of all this horrible stuff. And the session was going nowhere. And I don't know, the doctor said something one day, but what was interesting about this dude was that he saw his soul and it always stood 10 feet outside of his body, wouldn't look at him, wouldn't have anything to do with him. And this is what irritated the hell out of him and what brought him into the therapy session. And so the doctor says something one day, and this guy just flies into this rage, and he carried a Bowie knife with him. He pulls his Bowie knife out. He sticks it up against the doctor's Adam's apple and says, I'm going to slit your throat. And what the doctor does is he keeps repeating, what about her? What about her? What about her? All of a sudden, he drops the knife, starts crying, the first time he's ever cried since being in the service. Mm-hmm. And he says, Doc, she finally came back home.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the term in shamanic work is soul retrieval. That it's typically not as obvious as, you know, your entire, and it is the feminine side, the part of you that is who you are at the core level, being outside of you, but it's usually pieces of you that you lose. And because you don't have those pieces, life just can't work. And that's a methodology and a perspective that's in healing in indigenous cultures all over the world. And, you know, it's documented for thousands of years, is this idea that in some terrible event, and sometimes they'll say it's not just with this body, that it's in past lives, if that's part of your perspective, that terrible things happened and you never resolved the terrible thing that happened. So you left that part of yourself behind, still dealing with it.
I would agree with you. And go ahead.
Well, just I'm always fascinated where, you know, I have this perspective as someone who's a shamanic practitioner and a healer, and the people who are using other methods come up with exactly the same thing.
And a lot of my book is like a shamanic experience, basically. You know,
I thought so.
Only I made a figure inside me, an old man, an old Indian, who basically guides me. And sometimes I listen to him, sometimes I don't. But he was a very healing figure for me, and directed, you know, basically a lot of how the book went.
Yeah. So in the terminology in my world, that would be your spirit guide. And
yes, exactly. Yes.
Someone who is there and very palpable, and someone that shows up and you can talk to and get advice from. But from the classical psychological point of view, would be, you know, something that you imagine, or a part of your personality, of how they want to look at it. But there's tremendous value and power in seeing it as somebody outside yourself that comes to help. And that has a different perspective, and that's looking at it from their wisdom and from outside of you, and can bring that to you. So, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't get a copy of the book, and I've only read a summary, because I got the feeling that it really does have that depth of being a shamanic journey. Come up with a way to talk about all of that in much more concrete terms. So that, you know, wonderful, wonderful stuff that you're doing. And I know it'll help a lot of people. How would you summarize what you've come up with and how you work with people with PTSD, besides obviously the process of getting the story out? And telling it to someone. What else? What other kinds of supportive things and perspectives do you give people to work with?
And really, that you know, I use the method of Jungian psychology, which is active imagination. I found that works really well. You know, because you know, sometimes if they can't, you know, aren't able to project something outside themselves onto another person to find the healing, they can do those. You can do projections both in and out. So right. When you project in, sometimes that those figures that arise in your own imagination can be just as helpful if you listen to them.
they can be exactly. So one of the notes I see here is about living symbolically rather than literally. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that there's a natural law that nature must be obeyed one way or the other. As a an animal, you know, who sees images, and you just live the image as you see it, or as a conscious human being, you know, that looks for the meaning of the images rather than living them out. And a good example of that, like when a soldier wants to commit suicide, he really doesn't want to kill himself. He wants to kill an image of himself that's no longer him or never really did suit him. And, you know, sometimes he can only do that, you know, by either, like you said, projecting it out or projecting it into it, going back into his imagination. And when he does that, he's definitely has to slay that beast before it kills him, because it'll kill you if you don't deal with it.
I would imagine that it's also just the pain. You know, that the drugs and alcohol and being unable to function is just that everything, the psychological pain of what you're carrying around and think you can never talk about is overwhelming.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, those guys really need the opportunities, which I don't think they're getting, you know, to unload that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you know, I don't know where they turn other than some of these alternatives that we've talked about throughout the show.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder about the guys, especially in special forces of various kinds, who I have tremendous respect for. It's like, how do they even manage to do what they do? Both in terms of skill, but also in terms of what they're tasked to do. And they come out and they go into the private paramilitary world, you know, security and black ops organizations that still exist. And they never, I'm guessing, you know, this is all conjecture. They never process the stuff we're talking about because they don't need to. They're still doing their work. And
yeah, you know, and I think the other thing is that for some of those guys, I think you know, the guys that suffer PTSD, there's more of that moral conflict, you know,
right,
that their human side, you know, it tells them that it was wrong to kill, but yet there's this BC side that says it's okay. And I think that for those special op guys, they've built up a system or philosophical system or whatever that convinces them that killing these guys is the right thing to do, and it should be done, and it's all right, you know. So they've got something that, you know, but, you know, I often wonder sometimes about their lives, you know, later on, if this stuff doesn't come back to haunt them, you know, without having ever talked to one, I really don't know.
Right. Right. Well, and, you know, in the military world and in other places where people hurt each other, you know, organized crime all comes to mind. There are certainly people who are sociopaths and don't have that circuitry in their makeup to have the moral distress. You know, they're very single focused on it, and the consequences to other people really don't enter into their emotions at all. And and there seem to be more and more of them in a wider range of the arenas in the United States at the moment. And that's probably more frightening, at least to me, than anything else. And there are entire philosophies based on that kind of inability to empathize. You know, what comes to mind is Ayn Rand's work, and some of the stuff that she says, which has become very popular and lets people have a perspective that they don't have to take care of each other.
Sure.
You know, and that's, I was talking to a friend who has met a group of people from Africa who are here in the United States. They're musicians and students, and they talk about their perspective from the culture that they grew up in. And it's much more like the Native American cultures before everything got screwy. Very attached to the land, but very connected to each other and responsible for each other. And there's something that happened in the, I don't know if it's the Industrial Revolution or capitalism or where the original thought form came from, that separates people in a profound way and makes the idea of family very, very small. And it used to be very, very large.
We become centered on me. Everything's for me. And what the industrial society does is it, you know, says, hey, I don't need anybody. I can go out and get all this stuff on my own. I can get a good job and I can have it all. And you don't need people. You don't have to depend on anybody. I mean, I've experienced a lot of that in my own life with my relationships with friends and family. You become self-reliant, basically. And, you know, if you're making the money, you can do that. Now, whether you're going to be happy about it or not, I don't know.
Right. But, well, it's a model of life that's based on separation into small units. You know, people live in apartments, families don't live together, people are very mobile, and so are not connected in the same way that we used to be connected to a larger group like a village. So it's much more conducive to being able to just write people off as not being of consequence in your particular circumstances. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah, and so, I think where the future lies is us going sort of back to sort of a village type existence where, you know, you find your work there, you relate to the people there, and you see this like with Mondragon experiment in Spain, which has been going since the 50s, which is a cooperative that has grown to the size of where they have their own banks, their own schools, their own hospitals, everything. And like when the recession hit, their people didn't suffer because of the recession. What they did was that they laid off people, if they had to lay anybody off, which was very few, and actually paid them 2/3 of their salary. And then if the recession was going to go on longer where they still needed to lay off people, those two-thirds were going to come, that group of people was going to come back, and then another group of people would go out for two-thirds of their salary. And, you know, they don't make, nobody in the whole system makes 10 times more than the lowest pay. And, you know, I think there's so much righteousness there that just is not in our culture right now with the chasm between the haves and the have-nots.
And that has the Mondragon system in Spain is pretty amazing, and most people have never heard of it. So, EJ, this hour has gone by extremely quickly. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with our listeners. My guest is EJ Drury, the author of A Different Kind of Sentinel, and it brings us some very profound wisdom from the point of view of military veteran, but also I think much, much deeper than that, something that we can all get a whole lot of perspective on our own lives. So give everybody the web information again.
Sure. You can find the book at Amazon.com, both the ebook and the print book, and you can also find it at www.rivendellbooks.com. And you can also find me on Facebook, where I blog at Sir EJ Drury, D-R-U-R-Y, Roman numeral 2, Facebook.
Yeah, where'd you come up with
this? I want to thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, my pleasure.
I want to thank you for having me on your show. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, it's absolutely a pleasure. And I encourage people to find you on Facebook so they can connect over time with you. Where'd you come up with the Sir thing?
Actually, it's a nom de plume. If you read the book, in the first chapter, there's this I am who am figure that dubs me a knight, and he wants me to go in search of something. And
gotcha.
Then at the very end of the book, I get dubbed Sir Eador again. So that's where the Sir comes from. I thought, oh, what a gotcha. Great nom de plume. I'll keep it.
Love it. Hey, I will friend you on Facebook so we can keep the conversation going on. I encourage other people to do that.
Sounds good. I enjoy that.
Again, my guest is EJ Drury, the author of A Different Kind of Sentinel, which I will be getting my hands on because I definitely want to read the entire book. I only got pieces of it. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. You take care of yourself now.
Take care. And bye. If this has made you curious about my work, you can find me at househealing.com. And cleverly hiding on the contact tab, you will find every conceivable way to get in touch with me, including my online scheduling calendar that lets you make an appointment to have some phone time with me. I do a 20-minute free assessment, and we can see how my work might be helpful to you. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a wonderful week.
My name is Ruth Roosey. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for really? My name is Ruth Roosey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.